Yesterday I was asked an interesting question, which at the time I thought was rather a strange question, but I think it merits further discussion. The question was that, considering the present generation is, or people in the modern age are not much affected by Mayavad, why do we go on preaching against it? I was rather surprised at the question, because in my estimation, people in the modern age are very much affected by Mayavad. But first of all, we should consider, but let's understand what this Mayavad means and why we should oppose it. Yeah, Mayavad is the term most commonly used by Gauriya Vaishnavas for the Advaitavad. It's better known outside Gauriya circles as the Advaitavad, which is particularly associated with Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya didn't invent Advaitavad, but he established it very strongly by his writings, especially his Sharirika Bhashya, his commentary on Vedanta Sutra, and in other works such as famous works, Vivek Churamani, in which he seeks to establish that this world is completely false, and the reality is spiritual, but that in reality there is no variety. So in technical terms, another term for this is nirvisheshavad. It means the idea that in reality there is no variety. We experience at every moment in our present situation variety. For instance, everything is an instance of it, but I am not you and you are not me. Contrary to the opinion of one gentleman called John Lennon, who sung a famous song, "I am you and you are me and we are all together." Don't worry. So the idea that there is no variety in reality, that we see variety, we hear variety, we taste variety, through all our senses we experience variety. But this material world is miserable. That we can understand from experiencing these varieties. And of course, Shankaracharya did not predicate his philosophy simply on experience. That was done by Buddha. But he called on particularly the Shruti, the what is known as the original Vedas, and the Vedanta Sutra. Vedanta Sutras to justify his position. And actually Prasthantrayi and also Bhagavad Gita, in which we have, in Bhagavad Gita is very clearly stated, Dukhalayam, this world is full of misery, And yehi sang sparsha ja bhoga dukha yoni evate adyanta vanta kontayana teshi ramate buddhaha. That sense experience, the attempt to enjoy sensual experience, simply generates distress. In its inception, in its doing, and in the aftermath. And therefore an intelligent person does not take pleasure in this. So Shankara posits that this world is miserable. How does the misery arise? From attempting to enjoy the varieties of this world. Buddha Dev presented practically the same philosophy. He says that suffering arises from desire, so we should stop all desires. So Shankara, he said, he posited that because we see variety in this world, and this world is full of suffering, and Brahma, the Supreme Reality, is described in Shruti as Anandamaya, full of bliss. Therefore, we have to conclude that this world is simply illusory, because there's no pleasure here. And he attempted to establish this on the basis of Shastra. There's a major problem, actually there are many major problems with this. One of them being that in Shastra there are many statements which clearly establish that Brahma, the Supreme Reality, is not varietyless. So to attempt to establish his philosophy, Shankaracharya, he made a very complex system of grammatical interpretation and logical manipulation to come to the conclusion that the jiva, the individual living being, and the supreme living being are ultimately the same. This Advaitavad, called by Gaurīya Vaiṣṇavas Mayavad, has been the subject of major philosophical contention within India for centuries. And to answer Shankara's Advaitavad, Vaishnavas who oppose it, they're not the only ones who oppose it, because Vaishnavas are not the only group of philosophers within India. So Shankara is also, well, he himself put himself very much in opposition to the Mimamsakas, to all the other schools, Sankhya philosophy, Buddhists and Jains. So India was for centuries a philosophical battleground with various proponents of various philosophies, and especially Ramanuja and later Madhvacharya very strongly opposed Shankara's Advaitavad, commenting on the same texts as he did. Shruti, especially Shankara dealt with the Upanishads, the Uttara Mimamsa, the what you could call the philosophical or the more directly spiritual portion, and the Vedanta Sutras. Hare Krishna. So, Ramanuja and Madhva and their followers, because they, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Swagatam, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Yeah, so Ramanuja and Madhva and their followers, they by necessity, in refuting Shankara's Advaitavad, they addressed it in the same terms that he presented it. They referred to the same shastras, and they pointed out where he had made mistakes, where he had wrongly applied rules of grammar and logic, and so it becomes a very complex undertaking. So when I said that India was a philosophical battlefield, it wasn't like the modern politics of India, which is also like, it's a political battlefield, especially in the last few years. Politicians in India have become extremely nasty with each other. They used to be a little more gentlemanly. But this was, this philosophical battle was going on with generations of, among the Brahmins. Not all the Brahmins, those who are, to even partake in such a battle, one has to be highly learned. The medium of debate was Sanskrit, and those who could even partake in such a debate, they would have to be highly learned. They would have to know the Vedas, Upanishads, Vedanta Sutras with the various commentaries. Knowing Panini's grammar in detail was a must, and not only these shastras but all their commentaries. So it wasn't for beginners, it's very complex. So it's the contention in the question that this Mayavad is no longer known or adhered to in modern India is, in one sense, true, because there's hardly anyone anywhere who even knows what this is all about. Even if we say Advaitavad, we'll find many people who never heard of this. In Tamil Nadu, most people have never heard of Ramanuja. It's a disgrace. At least in Bengal, everyone's heard of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Even the communists. Even the communists like him. They say he was the first communist. He stood up for the lower people. So in one sense, that's true. There are still this in Udupi, the Madhva Brahmins, they still teach the Nyaya Sudha, which was composed by a disciplic follower of Madhvacharya. That was by Jayatirtha, wasn't it? Jayatirtha, yeah. There are two great philosophical followers. So that's the That's the standard book for smashing Mayavad. And just in the same state, not very far away, in Sringeri, the place of Shankaracharya that he established in South India, they're still teaching the classic Advaitavad, and they still have debates. But it's mainly Panditya Prakasha. Just they can show off their how much they know with each other, but it has very little, no effect, you could say, on the lives of the on the spiritual lives of the people in the world today. So why are we against Mayavad if it seems to be practically dead? It's not dead. It's going on in another incarnation, or many incarnations, which means that Advaita means it can't be many, but there are many. There's a new kind of understanding or misunderstanding of all of this. Well, first of all, we should state that this contention between we should know ourselves as followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that this debate between Mayavadis and Vaishnavas is not simply some sectarian, dogmatic, biased, we hate you and you hate us and eternal enemies kind of dispute, but the subject matter is the nature of ultimate reality. Shastra gives knowledge of reality. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in discussing with the Mayavadis of Benares, in the course of his discussion, he stated that in the Vedas there are three subjects: Sambandha, Abhideya, Prayojan. What is our relationship with the Supreme, the establishment of that relationship, and attaining that relationship. So the Mayavadis, they also have that. They contend that the ultimate reality is without variety, that our relationship with that is that we are that, and the means to attain it is by renouncing the world and studying Vedanta under the tutelage of Shankara's followers. Oh, another thing I should say is that, yeah, like Nyaya Sutra is written by Shankara, made his philosophy. Actually, he didn't make it, but he systemized it. It's nothing new. In every day of Lord Brahma, there are Mayavadis. It's something inherent in the heart of someone who's envious of Krishna. So he made his philosophy, and then that was rebutted, and then there was counter rebuttals from his side, and it got so like this. In each generation, there'll be just like someone will rebut some points of his philosophy, and then in the next generation, some of his followers will rebut that verbally and in writing, and then among his own followers, there are different branches who interpret his philosophy in different ways. So, one reason that this classic Mayavad is not very widespread nowadays, there are various reasons for that. One reason is because of the breakdown of traditional education in India. At least up to the time of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, there were many brahmanas all over India who studied using the traditional syllabus according to which kind of Brahmin they were. That means they'd study in Sanskrit, they'd study the Vedas, Smartas would they would just, even nowadays you get people, they study Purohiti and Jyotish, and these are some practical subjects, you could say. And then there are those who are in the Advaita Sampradaya, Shankara Sampradaya. They would study the texts of Shankara and his followers. And still there are some going on today, some traditional Gurukuls. And Vaishnavas, they would study according to their Sampradaya, Ramanuja, Madhva Sampradaya, Dalab Sampradaya, Nimbak Sampradaya. These all had traditional followers who had trained their sons or sent them to a Gurukul for training. But with the advent of modern education, this all broke down. And so Brahmanas became, the sons of Brahmanas, they became officers in the British administration, station masters and things like that. Another, of course there may be many reasons. Kali Yuga has its own progress or regress. So another factor was that in the 19th century, Hindus, for want of a better term, found themselves under intense pressure from the impact of contact with the British. They had been under the Muslims for approximately 900 years, but they didn't feel any ideological or behavioral pressure from them. They felt that anyway, this Islam is a much inferior system of religion, both in its philosophy and in its behavior. Muslims are meat eaters and cow eaters, and so philosophically, at least the core of Islam is not, the sophistication doesn't even begin to approach that of the Vedic knowledge. And behaviorally, nowhere. At least, of course, within Hinduism, there are also meat eaters and there are tantrics who can even have sex with dead bodies and this and that. But that's the high level of the Vedic culture. It leaves this Islam. There's no point in any discussion because it doesn't come anywhere near what the Vedic culture has to offer. But the British, they perceived that their plan to control India would never work unless the majority of the Indians, namely the Hindus, stopped having faith in Shastra and the Brahmanas. So they deliberately planned to undermine that. There were many Europeans who came to India and were fascinated, highly impressed and highly appreciative of the highly spiritual culture here. But there were others who were very envious, and they had a deliberate policy of destroying Sanatan Dharma by attacking it in various ways. Just like this term that we always hear, Hindu mythology. That's it. Obviously, that's English term. And Indians, Hindus use it themselves, not knowing that mythology means that which is false, which, just by using the word mythology, if you actually know what it means, which fortunately most Indians who use it don't, but maybe they do, That's even worse. But it gives the idea that Shastra, which is knowledge of reality, it's all false. So they made this propaganda that the Shastra was made by Brahmanas to exploit people, and it's all nonsense. For instance, that there's a god with the head of an elephant, that's nonsense. Another factor is that the British, they appear to be very superior, the Europeans, by their technological superiority. They had weapons which were superior to those that the Indians had, which was obviously a major factor in their being able to rule this country. They were also expert in politics and diplomacy, divide and rule. That was maybe an even greater factor. There's also the time factor. So their technology was very impressive, and they had a very strong sense of superiority. We're the British, we're the best, we conquered the whole world. And they imparted that to the Indians. Now, in their... They would criticize Hindu mythology, but in their own Bible, they have all kinds of things, like God is speaking in a burning bush, and Elijah, the prophet, goes up into heaven in some flaming chariot, and so on, which if studied from the platform of hard-nosed science, is just nonsense. We don't say it's nonsense, but hard-nosed atheists, or hard-nosed means hard-hearted and skeptical, they'll say, well, this is just all nonsense. So the British, they actually made a program for translating all the books of the Vedas into English, which are still in print, with the aim of undermining them. The first translations were done by British, or people appointed by British people to do so. And obviously they approached it with an attitude of wanting to undermine it, and an attitude that it's all rubbish. That was their attitude. So naturally they were not able to understand it, and they pointed out so many faults in it that they imagined. And there were also things, because in the European mentality at that time, and at this time, 2014 also, there was the influence of the so-called Enlightenment and humanism, and so they found it abominable that there should be what they called caste division, that Brahmanas should be considered better just because they're Brahmanas, and then the Shudras, they're considered lower. And there were many, the pariahs, who were in a very low position and despised. And actually there is some truth in that also. It wasn't that the Vedic culture was operating very perfectly. That stated that Kali Yuga began with the misuse of their position by the Brahmanas. So that was one factor, and there were other things also, like sati, that widows would burn on the funeral pyre of their husband. Although there are several descriptions by Europeans who witnessed this, and how the women themselves, even when they were trying to be dissuaded, they went and they were completely calm, because they had full confidence that I'm going to join my husband. That was their chastity. A widow treatment of widows and disallowance of widow remarriage was another social issue that the British took up, and the Hindus felt themselves defenseless. Actually, in the original Smritis, or Dharma Shastras, which are meant for giving the laws to Hindu society, widow remarriage is allowed under certain circumstances. For instance, another thing they were very much against is child marriage. And the Hindus, they'd never been under such attack, and they felt themselves in a corner, and they didn't know how to respond. And there were various movements which came into being to try to make a modernized Hinduism. Or there was the Arya Samaj, which didn't want at all to modernize and wanted to go back to the original. Yeah, that's what you get for saying Arya Samaj. Even the sound system doesn't want to hear it. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Next time, Radhesh Prabhu, take note. Where is he? He wasn't. Next time, Radhesh Prabhu, next time we have a yatra like this, we should have an extra spare mic or sound system. But we're using it for translation. But it would be good to have it here also, so I could just switch on and off. Anyway, let's not talk about that now. So, yeah, there were various movements which sprung up largely in response to the European ideological undermining of the Vedic culture. The Arya Samaj was a movement based on Swami Dayanand Saraswati's interpretation of the Vedas, in which he denied the Smriti portions, in which all these things like child marriage, widow burning, non-widow, all this, he just denied it all and said we only follow the original Vedas and performing sacrifices and so on. The Brahma movement was very prominent, especially in Bengal, in which it was proposed that now we're having a new religion, the Brahma religion, which is not Hindu, although whatever few Brahmas are left, they're considered by others as being Hindus anyway. It was largely among intellectuals, and they tried to combine some elements of Christianity and Hinduism, and this appealed to many Hindu intellectuals in Bengal. And in Bengal, especially, that many young people were raised with British education, and they grew up despising their own culture and thinking this is very backward, because they learn from the British, just like Srila Prabhupada went to Scottish churches, colleges. But even though they went to British schools and they're indoctrinated, and they're still, naturally, they felt, well, we're Indian and it can't be so bad. So they tried to make some compromise. Brahma Samaj was one of them. And one such movement, which definitely became the most influential and is still influential today, is the Ramakrishna Mission, named after Ramakrishna, founded by Vivekananda. Ramakrishna's teachings and Vivekananda's teachings, they don't have, well, that's an overgeneralization, but they were quite different in their approaches. They are both what we would call Mayavadis, although they weren't traditional Mayavadis at all. A very important point about Mayavad, which I didn't state. Now, Shankara's teachings is that although he propagated that this world is false, ultimately we are all God, at the same time he encouraged the common people who weren't intelligent enough to understand that they were God, to worship various gods, particularly by the system of Panchopasana, in which five among the many gods are to be worshipped: Vishnu, Shiva, Surya, Devi, and Ganesh. So these five gods are to be worshipped, and among them you can choose anyone as your favorite. Ishtadeva, you've heard this term. You can concentrate on anyone. But the idea of worshipping them is that gradually you can come to the platform of jnana. It may take many lifetimes. So, Ramakrishna's famous teaching, which had a profound influence on what we can call modern Hinduism, is Jato Mat Tato Pat. Shankara proposed that you follow the Vedic regulations and you choose which god you want. Ramakrishna took it further and said it's not only the Vedic, you can be a Christian, you can be a Muslim, and you can, it's any path. Jato Mat Tato Pat means as many opinions, that many paths, which is often understood or reinterpreted to say that all paths lead to the same goal. Which is, of course, in contravention to the teachings of Bhagavad Gita, in which Krishna says, for instance, Yanti Deva Vrata Devan Pitrin Yanti Patri Vrataha Bhutani Yena Bhutani Yanti Bhuteja Madhyajin Opi Yanti Ma. Krishna says that those who worship demigods go to demigods. Those who worship the forefathers go to the forefathers. Those who worship ghosts become ghosts, and those who worship me come to me. And again, Urdhvanga Chanti Satvasta. What's the next line? Tishtanti Madhya Tishtanti Rajasaha Jaganya Gona Vritisto Adhoga Chanti Tamasaha. That persons in the mode of goodness, they go up. Persons in the mode of passion, they stay in the middle stage, this earth planet, this earthly area in a human form of life, that is considered the middle stage. And people who are in the abominable tamagun, they go down. So the idea that all paths lead to the same goal is not correct, according to Shastra. So Ramakrishna was primarily a Shakta. He worshipped Kali. Kali worship is very popular in Bengal up to the present day. That is a tamasic kind of worship, which is conducted with meat and sometimes wine also. But Ramakrishna, to demonstrate that all paths lead to the same goal, even though he was a Brahmana, he also took up at some point Tantra Sadhana, which includes, what is that? Mangsa, Matsya, Mahila, Malmutra, these panchma, that you should engage in sex, you should eat meat, you should eat fish, and ingest stool and urine, and this is some path of spiritual, meant for emancipation from the world. And he also at some point did sadhana, acting as a Christian and as a Muslim. And during the course of that sadhana, being a Muslim and a Christian, he ate cow's meat, which is forbidden, of course, in Vedic culture, with some exceptions, but which is practically a symbol, in India at least, of being a Christian or a Muslim. If someone converts from what they call Hinduism to Christianity or Islam, to test them, to test the new converts to see if they're real converts or they're just doing it for the money, which most of them are probably, they have to eat cow's meat. So Ramakrishna gave the idea, by this practice and by his teachings, he introduced the idea that you can do anything you like and feel spiritual about it. And that it's not necessary to follow the Vedic directions. This is the implications of his activities and his teachings. Now, he is lauded as a great genius, the culmination of generations of spiritual teachers. But the actual result of his teachings is that people feel that they, well, that's what he taught. You can, every path leads to the same goal. So whatever path you're on, it's all spiritual. And it's this kind of what is nowadays commonly termed in Indian English spirituality, where there's no set rules, there's no set goal, in which you just kind of feel spiritual, that we now among our devotees tend to refer as Mayavad. It's not classic Mayavad. Srila Prabhupada noted, this would be in the late 1950s or early 1960s, he wrote in Bengali, that those who presently claim to be the present followers of Shankara, by their behavior and their teachings, they would make Shankaracharya would be appalled by it, because Shankara, he gave the Vedic path, at least in behavior, that you have to follow the Vedic rules, Varnashram. But it's why we call these modern so-called gurus Mayavadis, is because they come in that line. We can call it Neo-Mayavad. That Shankara gave his impersonal teachings with the idea you can worship any god, because anyway, all the gods are simply representations of the reality behind them. That was the idea. And then Ramakrishna introduced this idea that anyway, everything's all spiritual. Of course, he may not have elucidated it in this terms, but later it came to be elucidated in such terms that, well, everything is all spiritual. So there's no real need of undertaking any spiritual path, but you can do. It's also nice to have a guru, and they teach you how to be spiritual, how to feel spiritual, and we can see this is very prominent in today's popular gurus in Hinduism. And in the kind of spirituality that has emanated from the East and is widely spread in the West nowadays, practically all the Westerners, we see so many Westerners, they come to Rishikesh, and they've all been influenced by this Neo-Mayavad, which has gone to the West. Swami Vivekananda went to the West, and although he was highly lauded for it, he didn't make much impression, actually. People, especially in Calcutta, they think that everyone in the West has heard of Vivekananda. Hardly anyone's heard of him. But someone who did make quite some impression and whose book, The Autobiography of a Yogi, is still, although he wrote that when? In the 1920s or something? It's still a popular book, and I'm pretty sure you can get it in the bookshops here in Rishikesh. He was another Bengali. Srila Prabhupada said something about that. They said, there's so many Bengalis that misled the people, and I'm another Bengali, I've come to smash them all. So, Vivekananda, Ramakrishna, Yogananda, Aurobindo, Balak Brahmachari, and Anukul Chandra, so many. He lived in America, in California, for many years, and his organization is still going on there. It's still quite popular. But particularly in the 1960s, many gurus, so Yogananda had quite some influence in the West. And then in the 1960s, the United States relaxed its immigration and entry laws, so it became quite possible. And at that time, air travel became more widespread and popular. These are all social factors. So various gurus from India started to go to America. Srila Prabhupada was by no means the first. One of the most popular when Srila Prabhupada was preaching in America was this Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who traced his parampara from Shankaracharya, actually. His parampara was traced from Shankara, but he didn't teach what Shankara taught. He taught what he called transcendental meditation, which was something like the kind of meditation that is described in Shastra, but only something like it, a long way from the real thing, and actually divested of all spiritual overtones. He actually said, this is nothing religious, it's just a relaxation technique. But it became very popular. And in this way, many people in the West in the 1960s, there was a great cultural foment, especially in America, which later on spilled over to other parts of the Western world, in which young people, especially from middle-class families, they grew up in much luxury, but they were frustrated with their opulent life, and they saw the American dream of materialism as being shallow and hollow, and they were not very impressed by Christianity, and with all these with being exposed to various strands of Hinduism and Buddhism and Eastern teachings. There have been studies on this. I'm just giving some summary. Then there's also, it's not that it all happened in the 1960s. There were others. There were Dostoevsky and different people who were writing, and their books got translated. So there were many people who took interest in what we might call Eastern spirituality, but all of this impersonal flavor. And among themselves, they thought, well, we'll read this book, and we'll read another book, and we'll try this, and we'll try that. And eclecticism, do-it-yourself spirituality. So at the present time, in the Western world especially, and in America especially, there are many people who, and of course another thing is the yoga, the practice of yoga. This Rishikesh is advertised as the world yoga capital. So most people, there are more than 20 million people in America who practice yoga on a regular basis, which is maybe more than in India. Well, there are lots of people here who practice yoga also. And although most of them do it just for health, many people are also interested in the spiritual side of yoga. But again, in this impersonal, but not the rigid impersonalism of Shankara, rigid in the sense that there are rules to follow. Actually, in yoga, the first thing, in the eight aspects of yoga, the first two are yama and niyama, rules to follow by which one can lead a pure life. That's the first thing. But that's usually no one teaches that. Maybe someone teaches, but definitely if you want to be a popular yoga teacher, you don't teach people to lead a pure life or a disciplined life. Discipline, maybe to some extent. So this is when we say that people today are influenced by Mayavad, they certainly are, but not by the classic Mayavad. What we often refer to as Mayavad in our discussion among ourselves, means this vague idea, everything is deliberately vague, that, ultimately, everything is spiritual. That's what Shankara taught, that Brahma Satyam, spiritual is real, and Jagan Mithya, this world doesn't really exist. So that means there's only spiritual, everything is spiritual, but no clear distinction between spirit and matter. So the Mayavadis, they take matter to be spirit, and the New Age Mayavadis, there's a movement called the New Age, which is an amorphous movement, there's no particular leader of it. They use words like love and beautiful, wonderful, getting in touch with your inner baby, and all these kind of things. And the main aspect of it seems to be that you feel good. Because in this material world, and especially in the modern age, people don't feel good, either physically or mentally. People are miserable. So everything in modern society is geared, or much in modern culture, let's put it that way, is geared toward feeling good. Why should anyone take Coca-Cola, for instance? It's a rhetorical question that I've often asked. Usually I say that because it's advertised. No one would buy it unless it was advertised. It just shows how stupid people are. But why do people respond to the advertisement? Because the advertisement gives the idea that if you take Coca-Cola, you will feel good. Coffee drinking, you're feeling, you get up in the morning, you have to go to work, no enthusiasm. Take a cup of strong coffee, get a jolt. And then you go to work and you feel the same way also. Okay, it's time for another strong bolt of caffeine. Makes you feel good. But then you get over tense and from all this stressful life. And then you need some other drugs to relax you. When I was a child, all my friends' mothers were on Valium. What's the common drug nowadays? still Valium? They're all like Valium addicts. I don't know if it's physically addictive, but psychologically it seems to me. They're all this mothers just drugged out all the time because they feel so miserable. So you take a pill to make you feel good. There was a Rolling Stones song about this. What is that? So although she's not really ill, there's a little yellow pill. Something like that. Those words I remember. These are my sanskars. Before I was learning shlokas, I used to remember these things. Oh, so take shelter of a mother's little helper. It's a little pill. Mother is feeling horrible, so take a pill. Now you feel nice. But actually they don't feel nice. So everything is made to make you feel good. And spirituality, so-called spirituality, is also largely to make you feel good. Do some meditation. Yoga makes you feel good. Yoga exercise. You're a creep, you're a jerk, you've spent all your life mistreating people. So you go to some course in which they tell you to, you should feel good about yourself. Don't shed all these feelings of guilt and feel good about yourself. So actually, if you see all these modern gurus in India or anywhere else, their main business, and it really is a business, is to make people feel good. And they come together in a satsang and the guru will smile, and everyone feels good. So it's nice to feel good. But as Sadhu Vaswani would say, I think that's one of his sayings, it's good to feel, or Sai Baba, they all listen anyway. It's good to feel good, but it's better to be good. Good is left undefined. So this idea that, well, you just feel good because ultimately everything is all spiritual. I could do this also, I'm sure I could. It's not that difficult to cheat people. So there's a major problem with this, and the major problem is stated in Bhagavad Gita. It's in four categories: janma, mrityu, jara, vyadhi. Or, in one word, dukhalayam. This world actually is miserable. And just by imagining that we are God, or by imagining that, yes, we feel... Some Mayavadi there keeps on pulling out the power. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Maybe we can rent a mini speaker for the next 2 days. It's every afternoon. It's miserable, isn't it? Dukhalayam. So you can imagine that you're spiritual. You can imagine that you're God. You can imagine, you can say love and all these things. Peace, that's another popular one. Give peace a chance. But the reality is that this world is miserable and harsh. And the reality is that we are suffering in this world because we neglect Krishna. And however much you can imagine that you are God, you're not God. So this Mayavad, either the classic Mayavad of Shankara or the modern feel-good version, it's all simply cheating. Because it doesn't present reality as it is, which is that Krishna is the Supreme Reality. We are part of that Supreme Reality as His eternal servants. So in that way it's cheating. And it, uh, it, it blocks the real need of the jiva, prema prayojan, that love for Krishna is our real necessity. The Mayavadis, they'll talk love, love. The classic Mayavadis, they don't go around talking about love, love, love. This is all something. But it's all unfocused. It's non-specific. You see, nirvishesh, non-specific. It's just a kind of universal feeling. But that doesn't change the situation that we have to suffer birth, death, old age and disease. And nor does all this talking of love change the reality that there are so many demons in this world who are making a mess of it for everyone. As long as you're sitting peacefully in America talking about love, you don't have to worry about people killing each other in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Afghanistan, now Ukraine, and in America, and everywhere. So simply talking of love in a vague way, it doesn't actually benefit anyone. One, the idea that we should love others, that is very good, but we should know what love means. Love means to act for the benefit and pleasure of others. That we can say, that's the symptom of love. Simply feeling that you love, that's insufficient. Now one may say, well then, okay, we should help the poor, for instance. Like Mother Teresa is famous for helping the poor. Although at the time there were plenty of other welfare workers in the world. She wasn't the only one. But she got publicized very widely. So, actually, what help did she do? People who were dying on the streets, she would take, they'd lived on the street all their life. And when they found, they'd go out and find people who were in the last stage of their life and bring them into her homes where they could die. Instead of dying on the street, they could die in her home. So what's the value of that? Anyway, they have to go wherever they have to go according to their activities. And if they recovered and became healthy, then they'd be out on the street again. And they'd wait until they're ready to die, and then they'd call them back in. So even if you say she helped people, which actually there's no real tangible help if you're going to become a dog or a cat or even a human being or even a demigod in the next life, it doesn't really help anyone if just to give them some bodily aid. But how many people could she help? Hardly a fraction. So, Mayavad, we use that in the sense of various wrong ideas that are non-specific. And even within so-called religion, or even within those so-called theistic religion, much of it is impersonal. Islam is, although professes to, there is no God but Allah, wa illa Allah, what is it? Illa Allah wa illa Allah Muhammadan Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad, PBUH, is his prophet. But they're rigidly impersonal, which they want. God is Allah, not a person, no form. Of course, he speaks, which suggests that he's a person. And he has angels, like Angel Gabriel, who are also persons. But anyway, I won't get into that. It could be dangerous. And definitely in Hinduism, this idea, there are so many supposed Vaishnavas. But if you discuss with them, you'll see they're actually, although they talk about Krishna and Rama, but they're if you discuss with them a little bit philosophically, you can understand that actually they're Mayavadis. They don't, even though they use the language of bhakti, but their core understanding is that ultimately everything is impersonal. So we may think that people in the modern age, they're just materialists and they're not interested, they're not Mayavadis. But many people are directly influenced by this. There are so many young people in India. Most young people in India are not directly atheists, or even if they may be materialistic, but still most of them, they are, if not directly practicing any supposedly spiritual path, they may go to a temple now and then, or they consider themselves, I'm a Hindu, which means they have some kind of something somewhere, some kind of spiritual orientation. Rampant materialism is definitely very influential in India today, but Mayavadis also. And actually you can put the two together. You can be a complete materialist, but somewhat pious materialist. So the successful in terms of having many followers, Mayavadis in the modern age, are those who typically they have quite well-to-do, middle-class followers, quite well-educated, and they charge them a lot of money to come to their courses in which they teach them things like personality development and how to get in touch with your inner baby and all kinds of things. And they may have some meditation in which they all sit in a group and together they say, anyway, I won't go on. Long omkar, people feel very spiritual, but there's no real substance there. And even if you try to discuss with the gurus themselves, who are supposed to be very learned, you can't find actually what their teachings are, and they'll contradict themselves one sentence to another. And their followers, they love it. They think, oh, this is wonderful, you see. Guruji has such a broad outlook. He's talking nonsense, but they like it. As Srila Prabhupada pointed out, there are the cheaters and the cheated, and most people like to be cheated. They actually like to be cheated, because if we accept that there is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then that means that we have to surrender to Him. You can't just accept it theoretically, you have to surrender to it. And that's why we often find that there are doubts. People come to Krishna consciousness, oh, I have this doubt and that doubt, or I can't understand it. Actually, it's all an excuse to avoid Krishna. In many cases, they're not real. Srila Prabhupada said there are two kinds of questions. One is to understand Krishna, and the other is to avoid Krishna. So, Srila Prabhupada was an Indian guru who went to the West, but he was completely different. And he appealed to those who were sincere, because he spoke what is the truth clearly. I myself, I know I was completely disgusted with these Mayavadis. I didn't know even the word Mayavad, but I was completely disgusted with them. In fact, the first time I saw Srila Prabhupada's books, my best friend at school, he had been to London over the weekend, and he came back with three of Prabhupada's books, and he eagerly showed them to me and said, I'm not gonna see those books. I know those Indian gurus, they're all cheaters. by the age of about 16, I formed an accurate impression, but there was an exception to that. So Srila Prabhupada spoke very clearly, and he distinguished reality from illusion for the benefit of all, which Mayavadis will never do. The Vaishnavas will attack the Mayavadis, but the Mayavadis don't attack the Vaishnavas. They just try to absorb them in one incoherent embrace. Oh yes, yes, you're doing bhakti. Very nice, very good, very good, very nice. They want to be friends with everyone. But that kind of friendship is not very advisable. So, I was surprised by the question that there aren't Mayavadis today. Well, there aren't in the rigid sense. And most people who we call Mayavadis, they don't know what a Mayavadi is. And often if we say Mayavadi, people in India think that we're talking about gross materialists, which actually they are. Because they say there's only spirit and not matter, but they're operating in the world of matter. So they equate spirit with matter and they don't make any difference between it. Even this philosophical discussion is probably too sophisticated for your average Mayavadi. They don't go into philosophy, they just avoid philosophy. It's just all feeling, feel good. But by equating spirit with matter, directly or indirectly, because they have no understanding of what is spirit, then they take matter to be spirit. Everything is spiritual. Sarvam kal vidang brahma. That's stated in Shastra. That's one of the, what Shankaracharya called one of the Mahavakyas, some phrase that he invented to minimize the actual teachings of Shastra by taking certain statements and misinterpreting them. Anyway, it's a very great subject and one that Srila Prabhupada considered very important. Srila Prabhupada defined his own mission in compiling his own pranam mantra, which might seem strange that he composed his own pranam mantra, but there was no one among his disciples competent to do so. So Srila Prabhupada's pranam mantra, the first couplet is generic. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Preshtaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine. So that is a generic mantra which was compiled for Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and was later used for those among his disciples who accepted disciples in, of course, the slightly altered form of changing the name in each case. Then in the second stanza, Srila Prabhupada stated, Namaste Sarasvate Devi. He defined himself first of all as in relation to his own guru. Gauravani Pracharane, by preaching the message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarne. He is saving the Western countries from Nirvisheshavad, Mayavad, and Shunyavad, which means practically we can say Buddhism mostly, and Jainism and their modern manifestations. So Srila Prabhupada certainly considered it very important. Before he translated the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita, he summarized the philosophical portions in his book Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. And in Chaitanya Charitamrita, the extensive philosophical portions, two of them concern Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's refutation of Mayavad. So from the very beginning of our Sampradaya, with what is considered by pretty much everyone as the most important and authoritative biography, for want of a better term, of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. There are two long sections in which there is a summary of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's defeat of Mayavad philosophy. And in the beginning of Chaitanya Charitamrita is established, one of the introductory verses establishes Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as Yadadvaitam Brahmopanishadita Dapyasya Tanubha, and so on. Ya Atmanta Yami Purusha Itisyo Sangsa Devavaha Shardaishvarya Purna Ya Iha Bhagavan Swayamiha Na Chaitanya Krishna Jagati Paratatvam Paramiha. What is that third line? Shardaishvarya Purna Bhagavan Swayam Ya Iha. Exactly the words, I forgot. Anyway, it's stated that who is celebrated as the non-dual Advaita Brahma in the Upanishads, that which is celebrated in the Upanishads as the non-dual Brahma is the luster of his body, the Brahma Jyoti. He is the Paramatma who is present within every living being and every atom. That Paramatma is his partial representation. He is the six opulent, decorated. He is full with all six opulences. He is directly the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There is no truth superior to him. So from the very beginning of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, its orientation in not only promoting Krishna Bhakti, but in refuting Mayavad that is established. All traditional Vaishnava Sampradayas, the four Sampradayas, the Ramanuja Sampradaya, Madhva Sampradaya, Nimbaka Sampradaya, Vishnu Swami Vallabh Sampradaya, they all reject the Kevaladvaitavad of Shankara with various deeply scholarly refutations of his philosophy. So Mayavad, it is important for us to know what is Mayavad. If we don't know what it is, we're likely that will hamper our advancement in Krishna consciousness, in as much as we are all influenced by it even though we don't know it. Srila Prabhupada in the 1960s, preaching in New York City, Krishna consciousness would always speak about Mayavad. And his original followers thought that he had some kind of contention back home in India that he was hung up on. He's talking about all this Mayavad, and they couldn't really understand why he was talking about it. But then one day it became apparent to them that the Mayavadis he was talking about were them, they themselves. That incident is described by Hayagriva Prabhu, that at the end of a lecture, Kirtanananda, he asked a question. What was the question? Why only Krishna? Why do we emphasize only Krishna when there are so many paths? And he went on. It wasn't really a question, it was more like a challenge. And he was quoting both Western and Eastern Mayavadis, because the impersonalistic tradition is not only in India, it's very strongly in Islam, and it's in the West also. There have been many what are called mystics, who by their mystical, mental or semi-spiritual wanderings come to realize that ultimately God is everywhere, in everything, and not a person. So it's not confined to India, although Shankara gave this a very elaborate philosophical construct, which is not anywhere to be seen in the Western world. So Kirtanananda quoted so many things, went on and on and on and on, and how everything is ultimately all one. And Prabhupada was listening, and his face was getting red. He was getting more and more and more and more angry. Then he quoted Srila Prabhupada. When Kirtananda had finally finished, Srila Prabhupada quoted from the last verse of chapter 9 in Bhagavad Gita that Manmana Bhava Mad Bhakto Madhyaji Mang Namaskaru. What is the. We all say Mame Vaishasi Satyante. Mame Vaishasi Yuktvayavam Atmanang Matparayana. It's a little bit different. So in his Srila Prabhupada at that time was using the edition of Bhagavad Gita to explain Bhagavad Gita to his fledgling disciples. He was using the edition of Dr. Radha Krishna, because at that time his Bhagavad Gita as it is wasn't published, and he said the translations are more or less okay, but the explanations are wrong. So he read from Dr. Radha Krishna's commentary on this verse, in which Dr. Radha Krishna says that it's not to the person Krishna that we have to surrender to, but to the unborn eternal within him. And Srila Prabhupada pounded his fist on the lectern and said, "Why not Krishna? Why do you deny Krishna? Everyone accepts, all the spiritual leaders of India accept Bhagavad Gita. Here in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says to surrender to him. It's very clear to become absorbed in thought of him. So why do you deny Krishna? Why are you envious of Krishna?" He became very angry, which Mayavadis are not supposed to do. But Prabhupada wasn't a Mayavadi. Mayavadis will simply smile. They will talk so many things, and when you point out that they're talking nonsense, which is all that they talk, they say, just words, words. As long as they're talking, it's okay. But then when you use words to point out that they're talking nonsense, they just, words, words. They reject the process of speaking. So that was a great challenge for Kirtananda and his cohorts. They could have just walked out and never come back. Prabhupada, they were his only followers. And Prabhupada, but he couldn't tolerate that they were going on and on with their Mayavad and listening to Prabhupada and thinking that, yeah, what he teaches is nice, it's another way which we're just trying out. So Prabhupada, in this way, he challenged them. Are you going to accept what I say and surrender, or just go on with your mystic musing? Fortunately or unfortunately, considering the later history, Prabhupada always took the good side. They decided to follow Prabhupada, although Kirtananda never got the Mayavad out of his system. So that's why it's important that we clearly understand what is Mayavad, not only because we're faced with this in our preaching, everyone is affected, but we are affected by it ourselves. If we have any sympathy for this Mayavad, then we're in a lot of trouble. Now, we may appreciate Mayavadis in some ways. Many of the things that they do are very good, just like if they do Ganga Arati, that's very nice, for instance. But it's the attitude that goes with it, that ultimately we're all one and I'm offering puja, but anyway, we're all the same anyway. So we can appreciate some things, Just like, for instance, here in Rishikesh, people are very appreciative of the Harinam Sankirtan that we're doing. Appreciative at some level. If we were to go, say, 200 kilometers west from here and do Harinam Sankirtan in any town, we wouldn't get the same kind of response. We might, quite likely, we would get attacked and maybe killed. That which is now Pakistan also used to be Hindustan, but now the Vedic culture is not accepted even in the superficial manner that Mayavadi is accepted. So we should see the good where there's good there, but at the same time we should understand that Mayavad, it blocks bhakti, and its present many manifestations, which I have traced in this short discourse to having strong roots in Ramakrishna's Jatamat Tatapat. That is harmful to bhakti. That Jatamat Tatapat, anyway, you can explain. Because Hinduism, as it was very ritualistic, many rules to follow, very caste-based. So Ramakrishna's response, he may not have been consciously doing it, but it was picked up on as this is something in which everyone can participate in. And Vivekananda, he was also, although Ramakrishna was from a Brahmana family, Vivekananda was from a Kayasta family, which was considered Shudra, but was highly educated. Actually, the same family as, same name, Datta, and the same family, distantly related to Bhaktivinoda Thakur and, of course, Bhaktisthan Sarasvati Thakur. So he was very open to all castes, we're all Hindu. He related how one time he was walking in the Mathura area and he saw a pariah smoking a hookah, and he said, "Give me a blast of that. Let me smoke also." And the pariah said that, pariah, that means chandal, bhangi, there are different classes, I can't even remember. Anyway, these are some of the famous ones. So he said, "No, how can I give it to you? I'm a pariah, how can I give it?" And he said, "No, you give it to me." So he smoked his hookah. And in this way, he showed that he has no caste consciousness. Also, he related that when he was in America, beef was being served at some place he went to. So he was open to eating meat. In Ramakrishna Mission, there's no restriction. But as a Hindu, he didn't eat beef. But then the people there said to him, "Well, what you're preaching, if you don't eat beef, then it's contrary to what you're preaching, that everything's all the same and it doesn't really matter what you do." He said, it's not what you do, it's about the level of your consciousness. So he actually encouraged people to eat meat so you can get strong. He encouraged you to eat lots of meat and get strong. He encouraged them. So he related that when he was in America, he was philosophically caught and he was obliged to eat beef. With no regrets, he states this. So this opened the door to all kinds of wrong ideas and much degradation in the name of Hinduism. Anyway, these are very big topics, and I'm just giving a summary which necessarily is a simplistic treatment. So, Hare Krishna. Now let's go on Harinama Sankirtan. Hare Krishna.